Welcome to a series of netcasts brought to you by Yale University.
Hello, and welcome to another Yale Journal of International Affairs podcast. I'm Josh Jacobs, and I'm joined today by Alex DeFron, the co-host of the show. Hello, Alex.
Hi, Josh. Good to be here.
The plan today is to focus on how technology is overhauling the world of work, but also to discuss the future of banking, whether low interest rates and poor growth represent a new normal, and the standing of economists and experts in the public discourse. Today, we're joined by Stephen Roach, who's a senior fellow at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs and a lecturer at the School of Management. Before coming to Yale, Stephen Roach was formerly the chairman of Morgan Stanley Asia and the firm's chief economist for the bulk of his 30-year career at Morgan Stanley. Professor Roach, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So the first question has a kind of a zoological twist. It's, will humans go the way of horses? So the US horse population grew sixfold between 1840 and 1900 to more than 21 million horses. They transported goods and people around and between cities and fueled economic growth. But then the steam engine came along. You had automobiles in cities and tractors in countrysides. Horses suddenly seemed useless. By 1960, there were just 6 million. Are today's people horses of the past? Will we be replaced by robots and artificial intelligence and suffer a similar fate?
Not even close. We are far more adaptable, creative, and intellectually muscular than the poor, pathetic, four-legged horse who has disappeared from functional existence everywhere except in pulling what is called taxis in Central Park, and we have a mayor who's trying to get rid of them as well. Actually, we had a guest lecture in one of the classes I teach, the macro debate, that addressed this very topic, will humans go the way of horses? And, you know, the hope and dream of the innovation-focused, forward-looking, aggressive thinking economist is always that we are creative in uncovering new sources of innovation that will replace existing technologies. We've done that repeatedly since the agrarian societies were dismantled by the Industrial Revolution. And the hope and the dream, without any substantial evidence whatsoever to back it, is that it will happen again this time. There's no question that automation is jeopardizing employment and low value added replicable tasks at the low end of the value spectrum. So it's absolutely incumbent on countries, rich and poor alike, to invest heavily in education, human capital reform developments to make certain that displaced workers are reskilled, reeducated to do new and better things. We can't sit still. Or those jobs will disappear with huge consequences socially for affected countries.
Where there's been similar replacement of lost jobs in the 20th century, for instance, in the post-war years, where there was the inclusion of women in the workforce, there was a move from 75% rural to 70% urban population, and that enabled us to replace some of the jobs we were losing. I wonder whether those conditions can't be replicated in the next sort of 5 to 10 to 20 years. I wonder what conditions you think will have to be in place to find new jobs.
Sounds like you've read the most pessimistic book written on the future of America by Robert Gordon of Northwestern. He does make the compelling point that we've done a lot of these spectacular one-off things that will not be able to replicate. We had a special century of great prosperity, and that's now come to an end. It's going to be tougher. Those are all very good points, and it just underscores the unmistakable fact that we really have to focus much, much harder in equipping displaced workers for the occupations and the skills of tomorrow. We can't count on new sources of job creation and labor absorption to compensate for that.
And you're no doubt right that humans' capacity to innovate and to find new ways of doing things is completely exceeds that of the horse. But do you think that the world of work will change, and in what ways? You know, there are predictions by the Bureau of Labor Statistics that the average baby boomer is going to be looking kind of 12 times in his or her career for a job. Does that change kind of the definition of work or the way we see work as like the central determinant of someone's value and the I suppose the rhythms at which people will work and the kinds of tasks they'll be undertaking?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that the whole concept and definition of work and the workplace are changing dramatically. The days of the office that I toiled in for most of my career on Wall Street, I can see offices basically being downsized dramatically. I always wondered on all those years I was working on Wall Street, even back in the Jurassic era when I worked, most of us were on the road all the time. Why did we have these fancy offices, you know, with beautiful furniture and great views if we were never there? And now, courtesy of, you know, the internet and sort of flexible work schedules that allow people to basically work anywhere, from their cars to hotels to their homes, the concept of work is changing. And that raises fundamental questions about how we measure work time, how we measure the productivity from those efforts, and how we reward workers who are working in these new and flexible work arrangements.
I wonder whether you could talk a little bit more about that trend in kind of non-standard working practice. And in the absence of ideas of kind of fixed jobs, and you mentioned about how, for instance, you know, there's going to be much more flexibility with things like working from home. I wonder whether there's going to be a shift towards becoming, it'd be more important for workers to kind of develop specific specialisms and a unique body of skills. And they think less in terms of a set kind of fixed job title and a set career path, but it's more in terms of being flexible to kind of market yourself in various different sectors and to develop like unique skill sets which can then be put into various different contexts. Do you think that could be a trend that we would see?
Yeah, it's a good question, but you're sort of putting out sort of two opposing views. You're saying deep specialization in a specific skill set, but then having the flexibility to move from task to task. That only works if the flexibility sort of stays within the skill set. I do think specialization is going to be vitally important, and to be able to target your specialization to different tasks within a broad portfolio of work assignments from your employer or from a collection of employers is going to be vitally important. It sort of raises the possibility, though, that what we'll have is a vast collection of contract workers who are peddling their skills to a variety of employers, and how we manage the assignment of those tasks within the sort of the challenge of adding value to society is an enormously complex logistical issue as well.
So I suppose one side of it is the side you've just highlighted and that we've discussed, which is the individual skills for each person and how they best prepare. And then the other side, I suppose, is government regulation and how we maximize well-being in an environment in which there isn't unbridled growth, or in which there isn't perhaps an unbridled growth aspiration associated with that we saw with neoliberalism. Do you think we need some kind of system that redistributes and shares the fruits of this growth, or that regulates to help those people who are in the kind of routine sectors whose jobs are going and who won't be able to share in the fruits of this growth in the same way?
I'm not a redistributionist. I think any time the government gets involved in deciding who gets what and how, we have an accident waiting to happen. But I am mindful of the fact that in this world we're in with rapid technological change, both at home and through the connectivity to work platforms overseas through what we call globalization, that the impacts on workers are far more rapid fire. They come at a much quicker speed. And we don't have safety nets in place that can cushion the blow of these disruptions. So I think the role for public policy here is to better align safety nets of workers who are disrupted by technologies and globalization with the need to retrain and reskill themselves in the meantime. You know, like, for example, we have a program in the United States called the Trade Adjustment Assistance Program. It's been in place, I think, since 1965 to provide assistance to workers who lose their jobs because of import penetration and trade. The program's a total failure. I mean, it has, I think, paid benefits to 3 million workers since 1975, and there's obviously been a lot more workers who are affected. And it's slow-moving. It's got, you know, limited stipends, and it takes forever to apply for it. This is an example of an antiquated approach to dealing with worker disruption that needs to be changed.
But what's the more modern approach? Like, can you have the kind of system that you're talking about, the kind of safety net system, when whole sectors are being overhauled or whole sectors are being destroyed?
Look, those are all, you know, great questions for program design. I mean, it's hard to envision, a system that is so pervasive that it could say, let's just say that the world becomes Uberized and the entire industry of taxi drivers vanishes from thin air. Is it incumbent upon society to take on the task of providing support to taxi and cab drivers in the United States or around the world? The answer is probably not. How we address that and whether or not we have the ability to decide if these are the workers who really need hard-earned taxpayer dollars to support them, those are deep social and philosophical and ethical questions.
I suppose it's not just if there's kind of a moral responsibility upon government to provide these jobs for people, but you have a kind of strategic and political angle, which is if you're going to see these forces of authoritarianism and discontent that we're seeing in this election with Trump, this is kind of fanning the flames of that authoritarianism, which is linked with these sectors that are being destroyed and with this economies that are being overhauled. And these what can government do about those kinds of areas?
Look, this election in the United States, as well as the outpouring of populism in the United Kingdom and continental Europe, the sort of populist backlash against globalization, or what the politicians now have nicknamed globalism, is very real. We have middle classes around the world who are seeing their real incomes under pressure now for decades. And they're angry, and they want more creative answers. They do not want open-ended trade deals that give away markets and jobs to low-priced workers offshore. How we address the challenges and pressures of globalization in this fast-moving, disruptive world is an enormous problem for global policymakers to come together on. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is a fragmentation of the political debate, with individual politicians in specific nations having isolationist ideas to wall themselves off, or wall their countries and workers off from these powerful global forces. And that's not the answer. The answer is got to be to better understand the trend and to figure out how to work within the trend rather than try to reverse it.
I think I certainly agree with you that this backlash against globalization is directed towards policymakers, but I think also it's being directed at economists. And you can see this with Trump, and you can see this with Brexit. There seems to be this kind of growing skepticism about the trustworthiness and the expertise of economists. If we talk about Brexit, for instance, you have Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, in March saying that leaving the EU would be, a catastrophic mistake for the British economy, and it seemed to make no impact on public opinion. And then weeks after that, you had Michael Gove, who was leading the Leave campaign, saying that people no longer trust experts. Indeed, actually, now in the last week, politicians have been criticizing Mark Carney himself and saying that he's politicized his office. I wonder whether you think that this backlash against globalization has manifested itself in this skepticism of economists as independent experts, and how you think their status and reputation can maybe be recovered in this moment.
Look, this is the purpose of economists. We exist to make politicians look good. We are scapegoats. And with some, good reason here. I mean, when you sort of boil down the theoretical foundations of globalization, you have to search long and hard to find, how this is rationalized within the body of thought of economic theory. And it really goes back to, early 18th century theories of David Ricardo, looking at international specialization and comparative advantage between Portugal and Britain, trading cloth and wine. And, if one is more endowed to do better in trading cloth than he did better off getting wine from Portugal. We don't live in a cloth and wine world anymore. Workers in developed economies produce knowledge. It's intangible. Those are examples from an old antiquated past that really are not relevant. So it's incumbent on us as economists to come up with better theories to understand the way the world is being integrated, and we failed in that regard. So I think, you know, the criticism of the economics profession is well-founded in many respects, but that doesn't mean that, you know, the politicians through their isolationist policies have come up with a better answer, a better mousetrap to deal with this very serious problem. But the point on the economics profession sort of looking inward at theories that were developed 300 years ago for a different society in a different context, I mean, that's a perfectly valid criticism.
Yeah, I wonder whether I could push you a little bit more on the idea of kind of financial competence and financial efficiency. And I'm thinking here about the work of Jason Stanley, a Yale philosophy professor here, who's written some pretty staunch criticisms of regarding the Flint water crisis, about how the governor, Rick Snyder, established emergency managers to kind of who were employed because they were supposedly financial experts who would then be able to better manage the water system in Flint. And his argument is that the idea of being an expert, being an independent expert on finances, especially in when it comes to public life, is a fallacy, because you can be a financial expert who can advise me as an individual on my own personal finances. But the nature of finance and economics is you have to make trade-offs, and it's impossible to be an independent expert for everybody for an entire society. And I wonder whether you think there's something more fundamental about the way that economists look at themselves and present themselves as these independent experts, and the way that they can.
So this is a criticism coming from a philosophy professor?
It is, yeah.
Has he ever taken an economics course?
I imagine so. I wouldn't want to speak to him.
I don't know. I mean, I know nothing about the good professor and his indictment of experts. I'm sure he's well-meaning and thoughtful and fairly sophisticated in his approach, but it sounds to me like he is taking one example of a very disturbing crisis and then exaggerating the cause and effect to try to find somebody who's he can pin the rap on. And, you know, to allow relatively low-income individuals to consume contaminated water supply for as long as was the case in Flint sounds like an egregious problem of local governance rather than something that is attributable to flawed economic analysis. So I need to know more about his critique before I could give him a big pat on the back for doing that.
What if the problem, though, isn't the quality of the economic analysis per se, but the mere fact of experts? So you said it's incumbent upon economists to perhaps develop better theories. But in this environment, it seems like the best theory, in the sense of the theory that's appealing to the most people, is a kind of post-truth one. So Donald Trump stands up and says Janet Yellen needs to be fired, or Carney's accused of politicizing his office for making Brexit predictions. People aren't listening to the evidence. It seems like they don't want to hear it. And this is, in certain ways, why Trump is gaining so much ground. I'm wondering, how do experts recover in this environment and still use some kind of evidence-based approach in an environment that doesn't want to engage with evidence?
Yeah, it's a pretty deep question, and I don't know if I have the right answer here. But I think experts need to operate within their comfort zone. They need to deepen their analysis rather than generalize their analysis, and need to focus on aligning fact-based investigations with the emergence of real-time problems. Something I know a lot about, for example, is the China blame game that has captivated politicians in both parties for a long time, blaming China for America's deficits that purportedly steal jobs or, you know, lead to the shuttering of, I think Trump said the other day, 70,000 factories since China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001. This is an example of sort of weaving or knitting facts together with an idea toward coming up with an analytical solution to America's problems. And if we, you know, beat down China, everything will be fine for America. Well, it's flawed analysis. And so what I do to try to counter that, again, is to stay within my own comfort zone, try to understand why we have trade deficits in the United States. We have a gigantic one with China, but guess what? We have trade deficits with 101 countries. And the reason we have them is because we don't save as a nation, and we must import surplus savings from abroad to grow and run massive trade deficits to attract the capital. China's trade deficit in part reflects the way in which they trade with us unfairly, but most of all, it reflects our voracious appetite for economic growth and not having the saving to support it. So it means that in looking at political arguments like this, you've got to parse out the responsibilities for that between those of us at home and those of us overseas. And you can only come to that conclusion if you deepen your analysis and as an expert rather than throwing out these frivolous inflammatory comments about this guy causing that problem or that guy.
Yeah, to talk kind of more about how, you know, we play with the numbers to a certain extent and use statistics when it comes to kind of our economic analysis. Secretary Clinton and President Obama say that there's been a huge job growth and significant recovery since 2008. How much credit do you think should go to the administration's policies?
A number slightly larger than zero. you know, we went through, as President Obama is fond of pointing out, the worst crisis and recession since the Great Depression. And so the recovery that has occurred in the aftermath of that was a perfectly normal thing to have occurred. The point is that the recovery in both jobs and output or GDP, as you pointed out from the employment side, has been woefully subpar. And so it's like a gigantic rubber band. When you pull it down in the depths of a recession or a depression, eventually you let it go, and because things stop getting worse. The Federal Reserve did a terrific job of putting a bottom on the crisis, even though they created the crisis in the first place. But when they put in a bottom on the crisis, things started to get better, and job creation did pick up. But you know, to start history at the bottom of the worst crisis and say we've done a terrific job, when you step back and look at the progression of job creation from the pre-crisis period to now, which is so pathetic, is a very careless and reckless and typically political way of making these things suit your own purpose as a politician.
On the pure facts, has unemployment gone down or have people just dropped out of the search for jobs?
Yeah, it's gone down, but a lot of it reflects the fact that those that consider themselves as participants in the labor force, that has gone way down. If you correct for the plunge in labor force participation, I've done the analysis, the unemployment rate today would not be the 5% that the government puts out, but it'd be a number closer to 10, which is, by the way, the same as the unemployment rate today in Europe, which we love to make fun of in this country.
I suppose the emphasis isn't on growth itself being the problem or on capitalism not being the most efficient way to allocate resources, but it's on the unbridled part of the equation. As in, do we need to scale back the rate of growth or accept that the historic increases in growth that we've had can't, it goes back to the question we were having before, can't continue to repeat themselves, or the cost that it would take in terms of externalities for them to repeat itself?
I don't think we know the answer to that, but I think we do understand that, you know, during the early part of this, last special century, as Northwestern professor Robert Gordon, the world's greatest pessimist, likes to believe, we did have a number of things come together that gave us spectacular growth in the leading countries of the world, the United States included. And I think we can, you know, serve ourselves well in studying those periods in terms of what it took to create that growth. And so we may not be able to replicate it, but just because the growth rate has been lousy since the financial crisis, I don't think that's a sign that we should surrender or give up and just accept weak growth. We need to understand what it is that's producing that weak growth and what we must do to counter and offset those effects and what it might take to get back to some of these earlier periods of stronger growth. So normal, not on your life. And I think the longer we call it that, the more defeatist we become in addressing our biggest economic challenges.
Yeah, I wonder whether you could comment more on your opinion on Professor Gordon, specifically like his arguments about, you know, the decline in productivity over the last couple of decades, his argument essentially being that we've failed to kind of innovate new ways of working to match the technological advances that we've made in the last two decades. Do you agree with that analysis? And if you don't, then what do you attribute to be the reasons for the productivity gap?
Well, look, I have always had a huge respect for Professor Gordon. He's a terrific economist, and he's written a provocative book. I am possibly one of the few people who's actually read the entire book. I had shoulder surgery this summer, and I was really bored. I had nothing to do, and I couldn't move, so I read the book cover to cover. And, you know, it's an interesting and fascinating description of the ethos of the American growth miracle over the last several hundred years. But what it boils down to is basically simple arithmetic. He points out several gigantic one-off changes, the mode of transportation, temperature right. control, plumbing, electricity, that he can't envision occurring in the future, rural, urban, female participation and the like, even healthcare and life expectancy. And I think, you know, the math of his sort of contributions there is impeccable. We will not be able to replicate those big changes. But what about the changes that, you know, he's missing that I don't know and he doesn't know and no one really knows that are out there that are just as large? I mean, you know, we have these futurists like, you know, Elon Musk, who says, I'm going to colonize Mars. Well, we all dismiss him. You know, he's a crackpot, fairly successful and wealthy crackpot. But, you know, what if some of these dreams really alter the economic challenge, the economic opportunity that we can realize? And they could come through, you know, miniaturization, nanotechnology, biotech, artificial intelligence that we fear is job disruptive, but it may end up being job creative. We have no idea what those are. But to just sort of draw the line on history at 1970 and say, look what we did from 1870 to 1970. There's no conceivable way we can do these big things again. I think is a, you know, is a real sort of compromise of our intellectual ability to, you know, imagine the possibilities. And I think a lot of the growth that has come over the decades and the century does come from that intangible aspect of imagination, going back to your earlier question that I dare say the horse never had.
And this is the final question for you. As someone who was involved with commercial banks for decades and who ran Morgan Stanley in Asia, I want to ask you a question about students going into banking and into these corporate industries. In 2012, there was a girl at Yale called Marina Keegan who sadly died, but she published an essay in a collection of essays, one of which was called Even Artichokes Have Doubts. And it addressed exactly this, which is the preponderance of students at elite liberal college or elite colleges generally to go as a kind of natural progression of their careers into consultancy and into banking. Her criticism was not of banking per se as an industry, but of the way in which people see it as the next step and in which intelligent people who perhaps otherwise wouldn't be interested in that industry go because they see it as having cachet. I'm wondering whether you think too many people go into these industries as a natural progression and what your thoughts are on how colleges such as Yale frame this as the next career step or do enough or don't do enough to diversify and make it seem like there are other options.
Look, it's a great question. I get asked that all the time by students who come into my office for career advice. I'm pretty astonished that, here we are, 8-9 years after a crisis where there's been a real upheaval in financial services in terms of lifetime career expectations, the regulatory oversight, and we still see students wanting to go into that industry to the extent that they do. My own impersonal or informal sampling of sentiment is that there are less of them today than there were when I first joined Yale 7 years ago, but there's still a large proportion. I'm just a believer that over time, as it becomes more evident that the opportunities have changed, that there will be some diversification that comes from student demand rather than through, university guidelines or dictate. It's not the place of an administration or even faculty members at Yale to try to discourage students from choosing one profession, one sector, one occupation or another. They'll figure that out on their own. And, it's a big world out there. And I think that in the environment that we're in right now, post-crisis, the opportunities that always seem so attractive on Wall Street will start to lose their tarnish, and that will affect student choices glacially, to be sure.
So you think it will happen organically?
I think some of that is already occurring, but very slowly, and I think more of that will occur in the years ahead. And, a lot of issues like, lifestyle balance come into play, and I think today's young generation of college graduates take these concerns much more seriously than, did the sort of, fanatic workaholics like myself.
On that note, sadly, that's all we have time for today. But thank you so much to Stephen Roach for joining us. Thanks also to Jack Lawrence for our theme music and to Phil Kearney for producing this podcast. In the coming weeks, we'll be talking to author and journalist Mark Oppenheimer and Daniel Magaziner, professor of history and African studies at Yale. Keep an eye out for those by subscribing to this podcast on iTunes U. You can also visit our website at yalejournal.org and follow YJA on Facebook and Twitter. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.